Well, it's almost like a modern day Jack and the Beanstalk story as we talk about Pillar to the Sky, a space elevator. William Forstchen, he'll be back with us in a moment. We'll talk about that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. I was fortunate enough to get an advanced copy of William Forstchen's Pillar to the Sky, a book that will be released in February. Exciting. This is in novel form, William. Is this one of your first novels?
Actually, I've written about 40 of them now.
40 novels? I know you do a lot of hard news books.
Yeah, well, I started out as a science fiction writer and then went back to grad school, late 80s into the 90s, and that was for history, and turned more into history, and then so I've written both in the fields of history, science fiction, and technology, such as One Second After, and now this book, Pillar to the Sky.
Well, how come you don't push the old novels from way gone back? I mean, we just know of as, you know, One Second After, and a guy like that.
Well, some of the old novels I kind of wish would just quietly disappear.
Maybe that's why.
And critics love to point out one or two of them to the neglect of other stuff. But in recent years, I never anticipated One Second After was going to go where it did in terms of suddenly hitting the New York Times bestseller list. And then I was given this opportunity to do a book in cooperation with NASA. And that's been a thrilling ride the last 2 years, you know, working on that book.
Well, it's kind of exciting. I want you to explain what it is and how it's going to work. But we're talking about the building of a space elevator, which would be literally a cable hung from high Earth orbit and anchored at the equator. Now, what keeps it up there in space? What keeps it from coming down?
You know, you just gave me a opening line I'm going to use from now on because I never thought of the analogy before, Jack and the Beanstalk. It does, as people are first hearing about this, it does sound like a Jack and the Beanstalk type idea. The idea of a space elevator has been around for over 100 years. The Russian school teacher who first worked out the math of chemical rockets, a guy named Zhukovsky back in 05, also wrote up a paper of how to get into space by using a tower. If you string a cable, actually you would do it from the top down.
All right.
You launch a satellite up, carrying a reel of cable, 23,000 miles long.
That's a lot of cable.
At 2 millimeters wide, yeah, it would be quite a few tons. And you string it down to the equator, and once you have anchored it at the equator, to a platform on the equator, the centrifugal force imparted to it by the rotation of the Earth will keep it rigid. And then you simply hook a climber onto it, an elevator, and you leisurely head up into space, and 3 or 4 days later, you're at geosynchronous orbit.
Amazing. So now, do you have to have it, when it's in space, does it have to be attached to the rocket ship that got it up there, or is it just like hanging up there?
Now we're getting into some of the math that people go, George, you really do have somebody with tinfoil hat tonight. Geosynchronous orbit is the sweet spot. That's 23,000 miles up. That's a spot where if folks are listening to us, say through some satellite hookups and such, folks who watch DirecTV and such, that is the sweet spot where if you park a satellite there, it appears to remain motionless in the sky.
That's right.
You point your dish there, that's the sweet spot in space. You'd have to extend the cable out another 10, some claim 17,000 miles further out with a counterweight on it.
Wow.
The analogy is, I know this will work well on radio, I'll take my shoe off right now, grab hold of the shoelace, and I'll spin my shoe around my head so people can see it.
Okay. Don't hit yourself. Don't hit yourself in the head.
I wind up hitting myself in the head or, you know, the fine lady that's sitting here with me right now. It was just, but it does work. I mean, we've all done it as kids, spinning something around like a cat by its tail. And centrifugal force out in defiance of the gravity that would normally cause an object to drop. Well, that works on a massive scale with building a space elevator. Once you have it anchored in place, that thing is perfectly rigid. Well, it has some flexibility to it, which we might get into a bit later, but once you have that, the cost, here's the reason why to build it. Right now it costs about $100,000 a pound to lift a satellite to geosynchronous orbit by chemical rockets.
Okay.
Once you've built the elevator, the cost drops to about $10 to $15 a pound.
Wow.
In terms of energy.
Okay, because, you know, when I get on an elevator in a building, William, you know, I get off on my floor and I go out and do what I have to do and I get back on the elevator and I'm gone. In this particular case, obviously, what are we doing here? Just getting payload up there? Because you get to a certain level and you get in the elevator doors basically open. What are you going to do?
That's where the fun begins. For one thing, we have, what, 10 more hours to go on this show? Because we can barely scratch the surface.
I should have you on for an entire week.
I just enjoy talking with you. You know, this, you get me going on a subject like this, and I teach college, and my kids know that all they have to do is divert me with talking about this or some other things, and we'll skip the history lesson for the day, because this is fascinating. At one point, I want to mention sports because I got a very funny story on that one. The main thing is hauling. There's two things. One, hauling satellites up that would have cost billions of dollars to launch before can now be taken up at a fraction of the cost. Here's the second point. That thing is like a slingshot at 23,000 miles up. You can haul a mission to the moon, to Mars, be it payload packages or, in fact, settlers. This opens up space to settlement big time.
How big is the elevator?
Yeah, just by simply going up this elevator. The cost for you and I to go into space would be about the same as a flight across the Atlantic.
Amazing. Now, the elevator that would lift these different size payloads would have to be huge, right?
It would start, you know, when they first started building suspension bridges back in the 19th century. They're fairly recent. Yeah, the Incas built some and such, but the first modern suspension bridge was built in Wales in the 1820s. When the Brooklyn Bridge was built in the 1870s, 1880s, people thought it was impossible. It was the mega structure of its day. When they built one near Niagara Falls, it started off with a kite, flying a kite across the river, and then taking the string, dropping it, and then using the string to pull a very thin wire across, and then pull a heavier wire, and a heavier one, and a heavier one. And then from there, attaching it to the towers, and you make your suspension bridge. To build a space elevator will be basically the same. Get that first wire up, just a couple of millimeters in diameter. And then from there, you put a spinner on it, and the way they used to make suspension bridge cables a couple 100 years ago of having a spinner adding more and more wires, layering it out, until finally, it's about as thick as your wrist. At that point, it has the structural strength to handle fairly heavy payloads going up. There's actually a number of different designs I get into in the book. One would actually look like 35 millimeter film.
Would it ever fray or snap?
It could snap under certain circumstances. One of them being, there's a great movie. I mean, I'm going to promo somebody else's movie here. The movie Gravity that came out a couple months ago.
Oh yeah, I saw that with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney.
Yeah, it was an incredible film. And remember, that's triggered by the satellite getting busted in a weapons test that starts chain reacting and busting other satellites, and then our drama, that movie goes from there.
Yeah.
We have estimates somewhere at 20,000 objects in orbit right now, ranging from functional satellites to a dropped glove. I think there's a Nikon camera floating around up there that's floated out of somebody's capsule. Those things are deadly. They could impact the tower and perhaps fracture it. So there's a lot of things are going to have to be resolved in order to make this work. Or think about that big meteor strike that hit Russia last year.
That's right.
We're having debris coming into the Earth's atmosphere all the time. There's ways of protecting a tower against that.
Is it practical, realistically?
Yes. Okay. That's what really got me going on this was I know some of your listeners who are real major science fiction fans can recall Arthur C. Clarke's Fountains of Paradise, which was published in 1979. I read that book. That's what captivated me on space elevators. I wrote a short story for Boys Life magazine on it about sports in space back in the mid-80s. And then my interest has continued across my whole career as a writer. So I've been spending a lot of time researching it. And then 2 years ago, my publisher approached me for working in cooperation with NASA on a project. To answer your question directly, when Arthur C. Clarke, the great godfather of science fiction, wrote about elevators back in 1979, he projected to be 200 years in the future. We could actually build this thing today.
That's amazing. I mean, I'm trying to visualize this thing. So the elevator itself, if you're going to bring the kind of payload up there that I think we need in order to really save some money, it's probably got to be, gosh, as big as a jumbo jet, right? The elevator part of it.
Actually not. The material that we're going to see that will be the new, you know, what triggered the great industrial revolution of the 19th century? What was it built upon? It's built upon steam and steel. Once the Bessemer process came in the 1850s, that they could start mass producing steel, you know, steel used to cost, before that, the modern equivalent of about $8,000 to $10,000 a ton. It's in the tens of dollars today. The steel of the 21st century is going to be a C60. It's going to be a carbon, rearranged carbon molecules. Folks can look it up either as buckyballs or C60.
Okay.
That's going to be the steel of the 21st century. With that, you can take a thread about the size, initially, the size of what the lead inside a pencil, and it will sustain itself, both from compression and tensile.
They're strong. These would be carbon fibers?
Yes. Okay. That's the construction material of the future, carbon fibers. Think of what that's going to do to building structures right here on Earth in 20 or 30 years, 10 years from now. Steel will be obsolete.
That's I got a friend in St. Louis who decided years ago to get into the carbon fiber business. He's one of the world's leading manufacturers of it. The company's called Zoltec, headquartered here in St. Louis. I think they're trying to sell the company now for buku dollars. But he started off doing windmills and then airplane brakes and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a company like that would get a contract to build this cable, right?
Yeah, and if they're going public, let me know.
Oh, they are. They're already public.
I'll talk to my accountant about this because I want to buy some stock.
No, they're already public, and there's been an offer to buy the public company, and there's a shareholder dispute over that. Some people say it's not valued as high as it should be, but I mean, he was a genius. I mean, he has made hundreds of millions of dollars with this idea. He was Hungarian, and took off like a rocket ship, literally. I mean,
this is the first I'm hearing about this.
Yeah, the company's called.
I was actually joking with somebody a couple days ago that now that I've written this book, I want to invest in this thing because it is the wave of the future. And, you know, we're in one hell of an economic pickle right now. You got a $17 trillion debt load. A lot of people think the worst days are still coming towards us. And after writing such a scary, heartbreaking novel is One Second After. I actually used to joke with my daughter. I promised her, I said, my next book is going to be titled Happy Bunny Goes to Town. I wanted to look at a positive answer for our future. And God bless my publisher, Tom Daugherty, St. Martin's Press, and NASA. Because George, you and I are basically about the same age. And gosh, do you remember when we were kids? NASA were, that was the heroes.
That's right. And by the way, you know our publishers are the same. Who's your editor?
Bob Gleason, who's been on your show.
He's my editor.
Yes, we share the same editor.
Yeah, we do. This is weird. This whole thing is weird. He's great.
Bob is fabulous. When he called me up a couple of years ago, I thought he was joking at first. Said, do you want to get involved in a project with NASA? I was like, okay, yeah, right. And he said, no, Bill, this is like dead serious. This is real. I couldn't believe it. I said to Bob, I said, this is like offering a kid a lifetime pass to Disney World. These guys were my heroes when I was growing up. They have always been my heroes. They're the visionaries of the future. And they have an opportunity to write a positive vision of the future that gets us the hell out of the mess we're in now. What a gift that was.
Yeah, oh man.
We have a great editor.
Yeah,
we can sing praise to Bob, and he'll give us a better contract next time.
I call him Mr. Redline. You know?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
He's one of those. Now, is there anybody realistically working on this in terms of structure? I mean, any private companies like, you know, Branson's company or anybody like that?
Oh, you've kind of hit like my major fantasy I can discuss in public. I'm hoping the book triggers that.
Uh-huh.
I am not aware. There has been a number of startups in the last 5 to 10 years of getting into space, of which you've already named one guy who's at the top of the list, and he's another hero of mine. That's Branson. They're looking at starting a suborbital business. They've already test fired it, and it works. And then from there, go to orbital. I am, at this moment, not aware of any company that's saying, we're going to build a space elevator. I'm hoping 6 months, a year from now, we're going to hear somebody saying, we're going to do this. Because it's doable now. They're going to have to do a lot of R&D, but it's doable now.
What about competition, William, from other countries that might want to?
I'd love it. Yeah. What pushed along the great space race of the 1960s?
Competition.
For the Russians.
Competition.
People instinctively love competition. I mean, it cracks me up, some of the new agey type education stuff now where, okay, kids, we're going to play a game and we're not going to keep score. Let's pass the ball around and share it together. Come on, kids, we're all hardwired to enjoy competition. So I'd love it if the Chinese said they were going to make one, or the Russians, or the Senegalese, I don't care who. Let's have some competition.
Has anybody said that they were going to make one? Is there a commitment out there
yet?
Not yet.
But I'd love to see a race for who can do it first, because that would get people fired up.
Book comes out when? February?
Book comes out February 11th.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back, chat a little bit more with William Forstgen about, of course, Pillar to the Sky. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll talk with him about this, the space elevator, and, of course, what we were talking about last hour, and that is an EMP attack or an X-flare from the sun. So we're going to go through both of those as well. Lots to still cover. The space elevator, Pillar to the Sky, next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. William Forstgen with us, talking about his latest work, Pillar to the Sky. Now, you believe that this space elevator would open up space to humanity. Tell me a little bit about that.
It's not only about opening space up for us going up. It's what it brings back down. And again, my thanks to the editor we share, Bob Gleason and Tom Daugherty. Tom helped kickstart this idea in my head as well. It's what comes back down. George, at this moment, humanity is like some people trapped on an island, and they're digging deeper into the dirt, to try and find water, and they're not listening to the guy, as you say on the old movies, say, folks, if you just go over the next hill, there's a huge freshwater sea out there, plenty of water for everybody. Well, that's exactly where we're at right now. There is limitless energy streaming past this planet. In our previous hour, we talked about the threat of a major solar storm. Well, the other side of that is solar energy. Build the pillar. Once you've built it, string out solar panels. This was talked about back in the 70s and 80s, but it was not realistic because the idea was had solar panels in space, but how do you get the energy back down to Earth? Microwave, lasers, ain't never going to happen. Besides, you need huge collecting stations on the surface. But once you have a pillar with superconductivity cabling coming back down, America could become the global exporter of energy for the entire world with building pillars like this.
It's interesting. It'd be
limitless energy.
Now, what are the dangers of a plane ramming into the cable?
We got a hell of a lesson on 9/11. And, yeah, this will become a primary target for countries in the Middle East, for example, that their economy would go back into their palaces 50 years later, would be covered in sand again. You need a good defense system around it, a no-fly zone.
You're going to have military there guarding it, right?
Yes.
What would happen if you sawed through the cable on the bottom, right? So it's attached to the ground. What if you sawed through it? Would it just snap or just kind of like float there?
Sawing through it would be a heck of a lot harder than a lot might be imagined, because you're talking about material that's actually stronger than diamonds. You would need a heck of a lot of kinetic energy from like a missile impact. Somebody chopping at it, they're not going to get anywhere unless they have a tool made of the same material or something stronger. In fact, the thin wires would actually be very, very dangerous. They'd be very barely visible. And if you just waved your hand across it, your fingers will fall to the ground. You'd cut your fingers off with this and barely even feel it in that first second. It's sharper than a razor. It's the strongest material on the planet when we start manufacturing this in large quantities.
Well, that would be a novel. The whole thing is novel. So we could avoid
I wrote
that
a novel about it.
Yeah, you yes. did. So we would be able to avoid that problem. They have to be guarded. How many of these would we have? How many do you envision?
Start with one. And in the same way when the first Continental Railroad was built, it was thought of to be impossible in 1850. In fact, they weren't even sure if a steam engine would operate at the altitude going over the Rocky Mountains. We built the first railroad in 1869, and then by the year 2000, only 30 years, I mean, excuse me, the year 1900, 31 years later, there's a whole network of railroads all across the country. Once you build the first tower, it becomes infinitely cheaper to build a second one, a third one, a fifth one, a tenth one, a 20th. Eventually, the world would look like a wagon spoke, you know, a wagon wheel with spokes going out, providing energy and access to space. It would completely, the beginning of the 22nd century, in fact, by the year 2050, the entire global economy would be transformed.
So you'd have elevators on one end, you'd have solar panels on another generating power. They would be used for all kinds of things.
Yes. Now, you put those panels up there 5,000 miles up where they're getting, you know, we're starting to see solar energy projects, whether people believe in them or not. I mean, there was a crazy proposal to build one just down the street from me. Up in the middle of the Smoky Mountains where it's cloudy, you know, half of the year. And it's also dark, just so happens to be something called sunrise, sunset, you know, night, day. Well, you go 5,000 miles out, your solar panel is collecting limitless energy 24/7, 365. Infinitely more effective. Sure. And then you use superconductivity cabling to pipe the energy back down to the Earth's surface.
All right, the military's going to say something, William, and they're going to say, how can we use this? How can they use it?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll be frank, I haven't really thought about that in terms of, yeah, there's military applications in terms of planting cameras on these things, et cetera. But as an offensive weapon, I can't really see an offensive use to it other than the fact that it's providing a heck of a lot of energy, a lot more energy than we'd eventually be getting out of any nuclear power plant or, you know, standard generating system.
How about a power beam generator or something up there? Some kind
that's
of
true.
Weapon.
Or you could mount lasers on the darn thing and make it uncomfortable for somebody.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now you got me thinking. We got to call Bob Gleason up.
Yeah, there's your second book right there on this one. Because, you know, any application that's great for civilian use, the military's going to get involved one way or another.
And, sooner or later.
Yep.
The other thing that fascinates me with this is the potential for sports.
Yeah, you were talking about sports. Tell me about that.
Activities. All right. Again, something I would urge folks once we're off the air, go on YouTube and look up a video called Grinding the Crack. I know it sounds weird. It's a guy in a squirrel suit, and there's a rock formation. I think it's in Switzerland. It's called the Crack. It's this giant cleft in the side of a mountain, and this guy in a squirrel suit jumps off the top of a cliff. It's an awesome video. Well, what would happen if you took the tower, you rode up 500 miles, and you stopped at the tourist destination there, bought some nice little tourist trinkets and such. You decide you want to go home, and you stepped off. You don't float off in space because you're not at orbital velocity.
No, you're falling, right? Yeah, that's right.
Would that not be the coolest extreme sport in the world?
If you had a parachute.
Oh, yeah. What was the guy's name? Felix Bamberg, the fellow who jumped from the balloon last year, 25 miles up.
Oh, I don't
remember,
know
he accelerated up past to faster than the speed of sound near the surface. But imagine the jump is from 500 miles up. You'd be in a pressurized spacesuit. You'd have an ablative shield as you came in through the atmosphere. And then once down to atmospheric level.
Oh, Felix Baumgartner. Right?
Baumgartner, yes.
Yep. Yeah. That's right. And he was in a spacesuit.
Right. Right. It was an awesome jump.
Would you do that?
Well, me? No, I believe I have a couple of World War II airplanes. Anybody who flings himself out of a perfectly flyable airplane, I think it's crazy.
Yeah, those jumping days are gone for us.
But, you know, I would do that. I would do the 500-mile jump if they ever built one.
You would?
You couldn't keep me away from it.
That would be intriguing. I would go into space on an elevator like that. I mean, I'd keep
going. Absolutely.
How long would it take you to go from the ground all the way back up?
Well, getting up to the 500-mile station... couple hours.
That's all?
Yeah.
They could get it. What would be the propulsion system to get the elevator up there? Some kind of huge electric motor?
It could be at the start. It could be as simple as a cable crawler, which would be relatively slow, or eventually they'd be looking at magnetic maglev, just like, we're already starting to see some maglev trains being built. What is that to prevent from going maglev vertical? In the book, I also have them going up using jet and booster packs.
If they ever create anti-gravity, that would be a way too.
Oh, that would be awesome. Yeah. NASA actually did sponsor a competition for colleges about 10 or 12 years back out of White Sands to seriously look at crawlers, how to ascend an elevator cable. So NASA has taken this subject very seriously. They were getting some funding on it about 10 years ago. That's dried up under the current administration. So I see private venture. But getting up to 500 miles, let's make a pledge, you and I. We'll go up.
But I'm not jumping.
I'd love to. I'll jump. I'll get down ahead of you.
Yeah,
but,
you jump.
Let's agree we're going to do a show from up there about 10, 15 years from now.
I would do that. Absolutely. In a heartbeat, I would do that. And we'll have special guests up there, and that'll be intriguing.
Yeah. That's part of the beauty of it, because right now when we think about going into space, it's been, I think there's been about 400 or 500 people have now been in space across 50 years. Branson's going to open up his operation. It costs $250,000 a pop, which is way beyond 99% of us.
Way beyond.
This would make space accessible for all of us. I think in terms of geriatric, my father shattered his pelvis. He was bedridden for the last year and a half of his life. Suppose that type of environment existed where Dad could have been in 1/6, 1/8, 1/10 gravity.
So Bob Bigelow's idea of a hotel, you could build it right by the elevator.
Right. Right.
That would be interesting.
There'd be tourist trips up all the way up to geriatric use, medical use. The possibilities then become limitless. All of us.
What floor are you on? I'm on the 10,000 mile floor.
<You know? laughs> Call room service.
Yeah. Could you imagine that? Oh, my
God. Yeah, well, your burger will be up tomorrow along with the bottle of champagne.
Yeah, exactly. What's taking the maid so long to get here?
But think of the view.
Oh, my gosh. What a view. Hey, honeymooners would love to do that, wouldn't they?
Your show's PG. We can't discuss some of the possibilities there.
No,
but we can
not
think
the
about
possibilities,
them.
But you can think of the possibilities.
Endless possibilities.
People
but we're not
would love
talk about it on the air.
How safe would it be, William, to get up there?
Initially, you know, we have become such a risk-aversion society. Look back at the history of aviation, 1910, 1920, the Barnstormers. How many people lost their lives initially? Yeah, I flew up to Baltimore this weekend and back. And the person traveling with me, I mean, we were talking about just the world of our grandparents, our great-grandparents. And here the two of us, we're smiling, we're holding hands, and, you know, we're just talking away as we go whisking along at 500 miles an hour. We don't even think twice about it. Well, 10, 15 years after you first get one of these up, it will be the same. It'd be like taking an airplane flight. It's like, yeah, okay. Now, we all know there's a slight risk anytime you fly a plane, but the risk just compared to the benefit of going to see friends for the weekend or whatever, sure, we don't even think twice about it.
No, you're right. You're right. Much safer these days to take a plane than to get into a car, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, gosh, I'm still the type that my nose is glued to the window of an airplane. No matter how many hundred times I've flown, to me, it's still a wonder. I'm always amazed sitting aboard a plane at how many people are just staring off board or playing something on their iPad or iPhone.
Yeah.
Rather than looking at the beauty of the clouds.
You got 120, 180 people up there in a plane, and it's just cruising along.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're everywhere.
Well, hard to believe that maybe someday it's going to be routine. People going up the tower and they're sitting there staring at their computer rather than marveling at the incredible experience of seeing the stars start to appear overhead.
Let me ask you this. Listen to this possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the possibility of an elevator, let's say be one in Los Angeles, one in New York? And mm-hmm. to fly from L.A. to New York is going to be at least 6 hours, you know, in a normal jet. Let's assume you go up the elevator, you get in a rocket ship, and it takes you to the New York elevator, and down you go. Do you think you could do that in, like, a bat of an eye?
Actually, that would be rather difficult. You can position an elevator offline with the equator. But the further you go north or south of the equator, the greater the stress loads.
Ah, okay.
The less carrying capacity. Because when you're on the equator, you're at a direct right angle to its orbital motion.
Okay, so you couldn't put one in Chicago, one in St. Louis, one in Los Angeles. You're restricted to the equator.
Restricted to the equator. However, you can, envision a high radio tower that next time you're driving past one, you see the guide wires that arc out to either side supporting that tower. Well, we'll see that with elevators. There'll be wires going off at an angle, perhaps as far north as L.A. or Miami. Those will be for carrying the electrical lines for providing electricity. There'd eventually be travel along one of them. Some writers speculate, and I'm one of them, that by the beginning of the 22nd century, not only will you have the wagon spokes going out, but there'll be a cable stringing completely around a geosynchronous orbit. So it would actually look like a wheel
up
and then
there.
Be built up from there.
Yeah, you may be right. I can visualize something like that. That would work too, wouldn't it? That would work.
It would be a remarkable world for our grandchildren. And to me, it's that building that positive vision of the future. Even while we're dealing with the crises that we're facing at this moment, we got to provide some kind of hope that the future is going to be better.
You wrote the Pillar to the Sky with NASA's cooperation. Do they, as an agency, do they want to do this?
They're barely trying to. They're basically trying to stay alive at the moment.
That's what I thought.
I was at Langley. I went up to Langley in Virginia several years back to talk about One Second After and the issue of CME, solar storms.
Right.
I was there the day after the Constellation and Ares project were closed by the current administration. That was our plans for returning to the moon and then using that technology for going to Mars. It was truly being at a funeral. I saw people in tears who had devoted 10, 15, 20 years of their life
gone.
To try and keep these projects going. And we are burning off, you're hearing me get angry, we are burning off the finest R&D team created in the history of humanity.
And we're letting the Chinese sneak right past us again. Stay with us, Bill. I want to talk with you a little bit about that, and we will have a full hour of phone calls as we talk about EMPs, solar flares, and Pillar to the Sky, the space elevator, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.